With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Tea and Murder, part book club, part interview show, all Agatha Christie. I'm your host, Rebecca Tundy Norman. I am delighted to have here with us today Sophie Hanna. She's a best-selling crime fiction writer whose books have sold many millions of copies and are published in 51 countries and 49 languages. At the request of Agatha Christie's family, she has been writing new Hercule Poirot novels since 2014. She also founded and runs the Dream Author Coaching Program. Welcome, Sophie.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
It's so nice to have you. It's such a pleasure. So I'm just going to start by asking you how you came to Agatha Christie in the first place. Are you a reader of her work for a long time, or is that a more recent thing for you?
Yes, I'm a reader of her work for a very long time.
Yeah.
I discovered her for the first time when I was 12.
Yeah.
My dad was a collector of cricket books, books about cricket, basically. I don't know why he collected them, because he never actually read them, but he had he had 3,000 cricket books in our house. And in order to find these cricket books, he would go to a lot of secondhand book fairs. And one day when I was 12, he came back from one of these book fairs with a copy of an Agatha Christie novel, and it was The Body in the Library.
Oh, wonderful.
Christie fans will know that is one of the best Miss Marple novels. It's actually,
yes, you
know, one of my favourite Christie novels still to this day. So he came back with this copy of The Body in the Library, and he said, oh, you like mysteries? Because I'd read all of Enid Blyton's mystery stories by that point. He said, you like mysteries, you know, give this a try. And I read it and I just thought, wow. And then my next thought was, I really hope this woman has written some other books. And not... So then I spent between the ages of 12 and 14 reading everything that Agatha had ever published. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, from that day, since that day, she has remained my favourite writer. And every 10 years or so, I would reread not all of her books, but most of them.
Yeah.
I was what is known in the Agatha Christie world as a super fan. And that's someone who's not just a fan who loves the books, but someone who's kind of obsessive, mm-hmm, and a bit like crazily obsessed with Agatha Christie. I'm one of those super fans, and I was, you know, long before I started writing Poirot novels.
Mm. And what does that mean to you to be a super fan? When you say you're kind of you have an obsessive fascination with her work, what does that look like for you?
I think the difference between being a fan and a super fan is that, for me anyway, as a super fan, I love even the books by Agatha Christie that I don't think are very good. I love the fact that she wrote some books which weren't as good as her other books. I love the fact that she also wrote books under the name Mary Westmacott, which were published as romances but really aren't. They're actually brilliant, complex psychological novels. I'm just kind of like obsessed with every little detail about her work, whereas there are other writers of whom I would say I'm a fan. So, like, I'm a big fan of the writer Tana French, for example. I think her books are amazing. And I'm a big, big fan of the writer Ruth Rendell. But I'm not obsessive about them in the way that I have always been about Agatha Christie.
Yeah, I feel similarly. And I wonder, do you think that has to do with, like, her level of productivity, that we actually just have the access to being that obsessed because there's so much to parse?
I don't think that explains my obsession.
Okay.
I think my obsession is more explained by, I mean, it could be the fact that I formed such a close emotional connection to her books when I was 12. She really was pretty much the first adult writer that I read. You know, I went straight from Enid Blyton's Mysteries for Children to Agatha Christie. So she was the first writer that I fell in love with, who was like a proper grown-up writer. And she really shaped my ideas of what the ideal crime novel should be and do. So she sort of gave me the blueprint, which I've never lost since the age of 12. She sort of defined for me what the perfect crime novel was. And it was funny, when I was asked to write Poirot novels by Agatha Christie's family, some of my friends and family said, well, how on earth are you going to do that? Your books are so different from Agatha Christie's. Because by that point, I had published about 8 or 9 contemporary crime novels. And I thought about it and I thought, actually, my books are only different from Agatha Christie's on the surface in that they're contemporary. And so the tone and feel of them is very different. But actually, when I looked at what I'd been doing in all of my contemporary crime writing, I saw that I had absolutely stuck to the basic kind of principles of what a good crime novel should be and do that I'd learned from Agatha Christie. Even though, you know, the texture and feel of my crime novels were not similar to hers at that point at all, I always liked to, for example, have lots of clues and make the motivation for the reader, you know, the main motivation is always the solving of the mystery. And I like to start my contemporary crime novels with a really baffling and outlandish and sometimes impossible seeming mystery. And that was something I got directly from Agatha Christie. If you think about all of her best and most compelling novels, she very rarely starts with, as it were, a sort of ordinary murder situation. It's very rare that it's like, here's a dead body, here are some suspects, which one committed the crime? It's usually like something weird, like somebody announces in the local newspaper that there's going to be a murder.
One of my favorites.
Yeah. A murder is announced. Probably in fact the best Miss Marple novel. So she always started with a premise that was so outlandish and irresistible and impossible seeming that the reader couldn't even begin to speculate what might be going on. And once you as a reader think to yourself, well, I've literally not even got a single theory about what might be going on here, then you're kind of in the literary equivalent of an arm lock where you just have to read on in order to find out. So when I look back at the crime novels I'd written before I was asked to write Poirot novels, I saw that they all began with either a very outlandish or impossible seeming mystery where I'd created the premise specifically so that the reader could not even begin to guess what was going on. And I'd got that totally from Agatha Christie.
Yeah. And so I want to get to you being asked to take on Poirot as a character in a minute. But before that, I'm interested because you're talking about how much her work imprinted on you in terms of its format. And I'm wondering if you see that beyond your own work in crime fiction. Is that something that you see kind of being a red thread throughout much of the crime fiction that you read? Or do you even read much crime fiction outside of Christie?
Yeah, I read almost nothing but crime fiction. Yeah, so what's interesting is I think I can tell the difference in sort of contemporary crime writing. I think I can usually tell which writers love Agatha Christie and have been influenced by her, and which writers do not love Agatha Christie and think, oh, she's all about the plot and she doesn't do, you know, serious, dark socioeconomic conditions or whatever people think who don't rate Agatha Christie. I think I can usually tell, and I think that the books I love in the crime genre are the ones written by people who do love Agatha Christie, because my main priority as a reader of crime always is mystery. I'm not that interested in crime. I mean, if someone wanted to write about crime and there was no mystery involved, I wouldn't read it. I'm interested in is that feeling of being desperate to know what has happened and being desperate to understand and to know the answer and not knowing the answer, but knowing that I'm going to find out. That sort of mystery and solution combination, that's what I love about crime fiction. And the people who do that best often I find that they have been heavily influenced by Agatha Christie. And two examples of that, well, Tana French actually is an example of that. Yeah. She's a huge Agatha Christie fan. And so it's no surprise to me that I love her books and that she does suspense really well. And two other examples are the writer Alex Michaelides, author of The Silent Patient.
Okay.
Huge Agatha Christie fan, and his novels are incredibly mysterious and suspenseful with brilliant sort of clues and twists. And the other example I was going to mention was Ruth Ware.
Yeah.
Ruth Ware, another massive Agatha Christie fan.
Yeah.
I've just read her latest novel, The It Girl, and I was on the edge of my seat, desperate to know what was going on. And, you know, Ruth really understands that mystery and solution combination and how important it is. And then by contrast, I read other novels by other crime writers where there's lots and lots of stuff about the detective's personal life. And, you know, maybe the setting is very well evoked, but that mystery and solution engine and that suspense just isn't quite there.
Mm. That's so interesting. I agree with you. And I think it is very clear. I feel similarly that when you can read a mystery novel and know immediately where their influences are coming from. And also if they're more in the kind of like Nordic noir genre or like the hard boiled kind of LA US genre, you know, these are all like, they all have their place. And I think I personally just respond best and enjoy most the kind of Agatha Christie English style mystery. And I think you're right that it's completely, it's much more based on mystery than on anything else, on the driving factors of, we are going to solve this mystery, but how are we going to get there? And I think that's part of why they're so easy to reread, because even once you know the outcome, the journey to get there is so enjoyable that you can reread them.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and I reread, I mean, it's so funny. Now I remember almost every detail of the plot of almost every Agatha Christie novel.
Yes, same. Same.
Well, there are still some that I do forget. So I couldn't tell you who the murderer was or any details of the plot in both The 450 from Paddington and A Pocket Full of Rye.
Ah.
For some reason, I've read both of those books about five times each. I still don't remember who done it or why. So those are good for rereads. I've also pretty much forgotten The Moving Finger.
Ah.
I remember a sort of atmosphere, but not who did what and why.
Right.
But most of them, I remember everything. But I still enjoy rereading them so much. Like every single sentence is so well crafted. All the observations are so sharp and witty. And I just still get so much pleasure from them, even when I know every detail of the plot.
Absolutely. And for me, part of it also is how much is fit into a sentence. Particularly in character development and character outline, it is so hard to do as a writer. And I don't think she gets enough credit for how sharply she can draw something with just a sentence or two.
I don't think she gets enough credit for anything.
Yeah, I would agree. I completely agree.
So many people say, oh, you know, yes, she was a good plotter and she made good puzzles, but the general view, there are some notable exceptions, and now a lot of academics are working seriously on her and sort of acknowledging that she's a serious literary writer whose work deserves to be studied. So that is happening. But there's still, I think, a view among a lot of sort of literary types that she's sort of fun and disposable and easy and not proper literature. And I think that could not be more wrong, that point of view. I think the mark of how brilliant a writer she is in a literary sense is how much you get from reading her books, even when you already know every detail of the plot. And, you know, she's got it all. She's got wisdom and insight and psychological astuteness. And it kind of baffles me that people don't see that.
Yeah.
I mean, agree. I think she's as good, as Virginia Woolf and Margaret Atwood and Charles Dickens, and like, I seriously do.
Well, I think part of the issue is how we rate what we think of as good writing, because, you know, part of it, there's kind of this idea that you have to like struggle to create a book, and it should be over many years, and it has to be this kind of like long suffering journey for the writer. And she was producing sometimes 3 or 4 books a year. And so I think people see that as like, well, it must have just been so easy for her. without understanding the level of intense work that was going into what she was doing.
I think we should, you know, I agree. I think that is what a lot of people think.
Yeah.
But surely we judge works of art or literature on the work itself, not on, you know, and I mean, I certainly could not produce.
No.
You know, it is incredible that she wrote such brilliant books so quickly. I do find it almost like magic, but that was because she was a great literary genius. So that to me is even more of an argument of why she should be taken more seriously. And actually, I think that you're right that people have different criteria for deciding what makes a great book. And for me, one of the key things that makes a great book is if millions and billions of people all over the world want your books by the bucketload, that is a good book for me. You know, how can that not be the main, you know, means by which we assess such things? And then when you think that on top of that, there's also all the wisdom about life and the human condition and the brilliant prose. You know, some people say her prose is not particularly special, and some people think it's a bit too simple, and some people call it wooden. But I just think her writing is beautiful and elegant and economical, you know, like a sort of perfect diamond or something.
Mm. I find that I generally do really appreciate her prose, but I also agree with something you said earlier, which is that some of her books are not good and some of them are works of like staggering art. And I think that they're part of the fact that she produced so much is that we get to see a bit of her journey as a writer, where sometimes maybe she wasn't so invested in it, or maybe sometimes she was tired or whatever was happening. Not every single work is equal to each other. And
which makes her more interesting.
Yes,
for those
absolutely. Absolutely. That makes her more interesting.
I love the fact that she wrote And Then There Were None, but she also wrote Passengers to Frankfurt. You know, I found that book thoroughly enjoyable, but you wouldn't call it it's not like a work of great literary brilliance, whereas And Then There Were None absolutely is. And the same person wrote both. I think that's quite cool.
Yeah. And I, for me, one of the things I love most about her work are the characters. Poirot and Marple to me are, I mean, I think of them as friends in a weird way. Yeah, I've spoken about this on the podcast before, but you know, then she also created characters who I absolutely can't stand. I cannot pick up a Tommy and Tuppence novel. I just can't. I find them completely irritating. So, I think there's also that for me is also very interesting that she went on to write a number of those books and clearly kind of enjoyed those characters, but she also created these characters that I absolutely love. So as you say, when there's more layers, there's more depth, it becomes more interesting to kind of explore the universe.
Yeah. Yeah. I love some of the Tommy and Tuppence books. I mean, I love By the Pricking of My Thumbs. I think
you do.
That is a great book. Yeah. But mainly because, like we were saying about, you know, really unusual premises, the fact that at the very beginning, Tuppence is in the sort of lounge in the old people's home, and this elderly woman is looking into the fireplace, and then she turns to Tuppence and says, "Was it your poor child?"
Yeah.
It's just so sinister and gripping, and you immediately have to find out this child. What's happened? Was there a child in the fireplace? It's just so, so suspenseful.
Yeah, that's true. It is a great opening. But I don't know, something about their relationship just I find really too cloying, and I don't reread them. That's just how I feel about it. But I'd love to go back a little bit to your taking on of the Poirot character. Can you tell us a little bit about how Agatha Christie's family approached you and what that process has been like for you?
Yeah, well, first of all, they only approached me because of something my agent did. They would never.
That's a good agent.
Good agent. He's a brilliant agent. So they wouldn't never have approached me, and I would never have approached them. I don't think it would have occurred to either of us to approach each other. My agent was at a meeting at HarperCollins Publishers, and HarperCollins published Agatha Christie, and he happened to be sitting in a room with a shelf next to him full of Agatha Christie's books. The meeting was nothing to do with Agatha Christie, nothing to do with me. He was just there talking about one of his other authors and something completely unrelated. But he noticed these Agatha Christie books, and he remembered that I was a big fan. And he suggested to HarperCollins that they should commission me to write a new Poirot or Miss Marple book. And he was told very firmly by HarperCollins that the family, the Christie family, would never hear of such a thing.
Right.
But the very next day, by sheer coincidence, the Christie family told HarperCollins that they were thinking of commissioning a new Poirot or Miss Marple novel. So it was purely because of that coincidence of timing that I was invited to a meeting and offered the gig, as it were.
That is incredible. What a good agent.
He's amazing. He's been my agent since I first started writing crime in 2005, and I absolutely adore him.
Well, that's visionary, really. Incredible. And so once you were approached, what was that process like? Did you say yes immediately? Did you have to think about it?
I said yes immediately. I'd done all my thinking already. You know, when my agent said we'd been invited to the meeting, you know, I did a lot of thinking. At that point, actually, I didn't know what the meeting was about. It was quite strange. But yeah, I had, as soon as my agent mentioned it to me, that was when I started to think about it. So yeah, when they actually said, would I like to do this? I said, yes, please. And it was a fairly... People have said to me a lot since, wasn't it a massively daunting prospect?
Mm.
And I've said, you know, I never thought of myself as daunted. What I thought of it as was a massive creative challenge.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is going to be the most exciting thing ever. I've been offered the finest ingredient in English crime fiction. And I would be silly to think of this as scary and daunting rather than the most exciting creative challenge that could possibly happen to me. So I just decided to turn those apprehensive feelings, or rather to define those apprehensive feelings as excitement rather than terror. And I also thought, you know, when I'm nervous about something, I visit the worst case scenario. And I thought, well, what's the worst case scenario? The worst case scenario is either I will write a book that I don't think is good enough, or I will write a book that the Christies don't think is good enough. And in either of those eventualities, we would just not publish the book.
Right.
So the very worst thing that would happen is I would have to say to the Christie family, I'm terribly sorry, I tried my hardest, but I just couldn't do it. And I was totally willing to fail if that was, you know, I thought, you know, that wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. They'd think, oh, well, and they'd ask someone else to do it who would be able to do it. So yeah, I mean, I just decided to define my slightly nervous feeling as excitement. And I thought, actually, if I'm writing a book featuring Agatha Christie's most famous character, then I'm kind of working for Agatha Christie. I'm working to remind the world of how brilliant a detective Poirot is and how brilliant all of Agatha's books about him are. So I felt as though I was sort of working for something greater than myself and, you know, really important in the world of crime fiction. And so it just felt like a really kind of amazing thing to be doing.
Yeah, it really is. And such a gift, as you say, to get a character like that and be able, as you called it, a tool. And I love that, because he is an incredible tool within a crime fiction novel. In terms of like taking on another writer's voice, was it ever your plan to try to write as Christie, or is the idea to take on the character but kind of write with your own voice?
Yes, I was very sure from the beginning that I did not want to try and mimic Agatha Christie's voice or her actual writing style, her prose style. I don't think one writer can or should imitate another in that way. You know, as a parlor game for the purposes of parody, but as a serious enterprise, I don't think people should try and mimic other writers. And I definitely didn't want to do that. So what I decided I wanted to do was write a book that totally reflected Agatha Christie's storytelling priorities. So everything her Poirot novels did brilliantly, I tried to make sure that mine did as well. But I was writing very much in, well, not in my voice, but in the voice of a character I had created who is not in Agatha Christie's novel. So all of my Poirot novels, I've published four so far, and I'm writing the fifth at the moment, all of them are narrated by the character who is Poirot's sidekick for the purposes of my books about him, a Scotland Yard inspector called Edward Catchpole.
Yeah, he's a great character.
Thank you. So all my prior novels are written in the first person from Catchpole's point of view. So I thought that was a sort of sensible way of approaching the situation, because I knew that I was going to be a new voice and a new person writing about Poirot. Mm. And so it seemed to make sense to me that my books would contain a new voice and a new character writing about Poirot. So that if anyone read my Poirot novels and thought, the style or the voice is a bit different from in Agatha Christie's novels, well, there would be a sensible reason to explain that. We're hearing from a different character, both in the sense that we're hearing from Edward Catchpole and also that we're hearing from me. And me and Catchpole were not there when Agatha Christie was writing her Poirot novels.
Yeah. And your books are set at the kind of, you know, the same time, obviously, the Poirot books are set. But did you have any kind of feelings about, you know, a lot of the criticism of Christie's work today is that it's out of date and a lot of it is problematic in terms of the language. Was that something that you were very keen on kind of wiping out from your work?
So we decided that my first Poirot novel should be set in 1929. Mm-hmm. And we decided on that for a very deliberate reason. So Agatha Christie didn't write or publish any Poirot novels between 1929 and 1932, although she did write a play that featured Poirot. But in novelistic terms, Poirot was unaccounted for during that period. So we decided that any and all Poirot novels that I ever write will be set in that period.
Oh, I love that.
And I wanted to set my Poirot novels at that time because that feels to me like the perfect Poirot era. Mm. And in fact, Agatha Christie did write about him, you know, right up to the 70s in, for example, Hickory Dickory Dock and Third Girl, two of her novels. Poirot is there sort of lamenting the fashions of the young people and why does everyone not wash their hair and why does everyone so badly. And, you know, I love reading about older Poirot in a time that he feels is not his ideal era. But when I was thinking about when I wanted to write about him, I definitely wanted the setting of that sort of 20s, just early 30s. That felt to me like the perfect Poirot era. Mm. And in terms of the attitudes of the day, I did want to include, I didn't want to make my novels unrealistic for novels set in the 1930s or 20s. So I had to sort of, for example, in the first one, in The Monogram Murders, there's a vicar's wife who expresses the opinion to Catchpole at a certain point in the plot that people should be with the people they love, not necessarily the people to whom they are married. Now, that was a very unusual opinion for a vicar's wife to have in the late 1920s. So that felt as though I was pushing it a bit, but I did it because I was able to make her a very unorthodox, rebellious kind of character. So what I try and do is reflect how I think things would have been in that time, but without using language that we wouldn't put in a contemporary novel. And that is quite easy to do. So, for example, there are places where in my Poirot novels, other characters express some prejudice on account of him being what they see as a foreigner. And I've kept those things in because part of the joy of a Poirot novel, in my opinion, is seeing how all the English characters underestimate him because they think, oh, he's a foreigner.
Right.
And I, you know, if you lose that, then you lose the joy of him actually being so much cleverer than all the people who are prejudiced against him. So
that's right.
Things like that I've kept. And, you know, so hopefully the attitudes of the time are realistically reflected, but I haven't used language that I wouldn't use in my contemporary novels.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. I want to get into the book that you chose for this podcast, which was Evil Under the Sun. And I'm just going to do a short little kind of historical note about it. And then we'll dive in. So Evil Under the Sun was published in 1941, the year after One, Two, Buckle My Shoe, and the year before Five Little Pigs, which are all Poirot's. It was published the same year as a number of Marple short stories, including Strange Jest and Tape Measure Murder, and was also published the same year as the Tommy and Tuppence book, N or M. Critical reception of the book was overall very positive, with reviewers pointing out the complexity of the plot and Christie's mastery of those complex points. It was adapted in 1982 with Peter Ustinov in his second outing as Poirot after Death on the Nile, which was in 1978. And the adaptation also starred Jane Birkin as Christine Redfern and Diana Rigg as Arlena Stuart Marshall. I love this little quote from Ustinov, who said, "I find Poirot to be a very engaging character, although he's quite awful, really. I should hate to know him. He's very vain, self-contained, and finicky. People have asked me why he's never married, because he couldn't solve it, of course. An ancillary reason is that he's very much in love with himself. He has probably been quite true to himself. I don't think he's ever cheated on himself." I don't really agree with that quote, but I think it's interesting to hear Ustinov's take on Poirot. Sophie, can you give us a 1 minute or less synopsis of Evil Under the Sun?
Oh, okay. Well, Poirot is on holiday.
Yes.
And I can't actually recall why. Maybe he's been advised to go to the seaside for his health. In any case, why ever he's at the seaside, he's not massively enjoying it. He feels, you know, too hot, and he's wondering why everyone's obsessed with sunbathing and wearing swimming costumes all over the place. So he doesn't seem in his ideal element. But there he is by the seaside. And because it's a holiday resort, there's lots of other holiday makers there. And they're very interesting characters. Some are kind of brash and sort of attention-seeking, and others seem very angry, and others have a sort of apparent love triangle situation going on. So there's lots of interesting goings on with the other resort guests. And then a very beautiful woman called Arlena Stuart is murdered, and Poirot has to solve the mystery. But that actually makes it sound much more basic than it is. I think it's one of Agatha Christie's most perfect crime novels. I think there's, you know, even among her best novels, very few of them are completely flawless. I think Evil Under the Sun is a completely flawless novel. It has an amazingly clever solution, so much unexpected, unguessable brilliance that you just do not see coming. Amazing cluing all the way through, a fantastic atmosphere and cast of characters. And I'm constantly surprised that more people don't name it as their favorite or one of their favorite Christie novels.
It also has one of my favorite Poirot tropes, which is kind of the omniscient Poirot, where he warns someone not to commit a crime. And they don't interpret it that way, obviously, until it's too late.
He
does that in Death on the Nile as well. And I love that Poirot. I love the kind of, you know, trying to say something and skirting around what he's really trying to say. So I do love this novel. It is very complicated in terms of all the twists and turns. But that's interesting that you say you think it's a perfect novel. What about it is perfect to you?
Oh, I just mean that as well as, I mean, there's lots of Agatha Christie's novels where there's amazing amounts of brilliance. So, And Then There Were None, Murder on the Orient Express, those are two examples. Appointment with Death, I think, is amazing. But with most of them, if I was being strict, I could find little things I could nitpick about. Obviously, I wouldn't want to, because it's Agatha.
Right.
I probably could. With Evil Under the Sun, I think there is nothing on which you can fault it at all. Like, the plot works brilliantly. The characters are amazing. The solution is incredibly clever. I couldn't, you know, find fault with it if I tried.
That's so interesting. I also think that one of the strong parts of this book is the location, the setting. I love the Poirot on holiday in the English countryside, you know, kind of that we see again and again. What about this setting do you think, what does it evoke for you, and what do you think it evokes for readers in general? Because it is a popular type of setting for his books.
I think one of the things that makes that sort of holiday setting so brilliant. And I think this particular seaside venue is very well described. You feel it, Agatha Christie knows it inside out. And I believe, I could be wrong about this, I believe it might be based on Burr Island.
Yes, I read that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is. And she would have known that quite well.
Yeah.
So it really comes to life. But I think what's great about the Poirot on holiday novels is that none of the cast of characters needs a reason for being there, because everyone's just there on holiday. So that makes it kind of harder to guess in a way. It's like, why are all these people here? Well, they're all just here on holiday. That gives them all a reason for being there.
Right.
Whereas normally in other sort of murder mystery situations, the question of why someone was where they were might arise, but it just doesn't if everyone's on holiday. So it has a wonderful sort of equalizing effect on the suspect. They're all in the same relationship to the place. They're all just there on holiday.
That's right. And Christie actually plays with that a little bit. And she does this often with Poirot holiday books, where all of the guests are kind of going like, well, why are you here? Are you here working? Is there some case going on? And he's going, no, I'm just trying to have a holiday. You know, he spends like all of his books where he's on holiday just trying to relax for 10 minutes. And there's just like never not a murder, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he never actually gets a holiday where he doesn't have to solve the murder.
We certainly never see it, no. Yeah, but Linda, I find to be really spot on in terms of being a teenager and being kind of, you know, so kind of within herself and angry, but also sad. She's got like really layered, complex emotions that she can't really speak to. What do you think about her as a character?
Yeah, I think she's a brilliant character. She's one that really stands out, actually. And you sort of can feel her pain. Like, you know, you don't blame her, or at least I don't blame her at all, for being thoroughly dissatisfied and for feeling a bit neglected. And I think she's brilliantly done.
I agree. And I think one thing that Christie doesn't do is kind of judge her father too harshly for the way that relationship has gone. But there is such a, for me, when I read it, there's such a sadness there of how he's kind of closed himself off to her as a parent.
It's really sad and very, very plausible. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of Arlena Stuart Marshall, she is, for me, such a fascinating victim. She's almost like the perfect victim in some ways. What do you think of her as a character?
I think the role she plays in the plot is brilliantly done.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is her as a character, but it's also her structural position in the plot because she behaves in such, I mean, I don't want to give any spoilers.
No.
Because if there are people who don't yet know the plot of Evil Under the Sea, I envy those people. I don't want to ruin it for them. The role she plays, you absolutely think you've got it all worked out and you know who she is and what she's about. And the way in which you think differently, it's not that you think differently about her character, but you realize that you've been making some assumptions about her.
Yeah.
Just based on nothing. And the way the plot turns out, you go, oh, so I was just assuming all of this about this character that wasn't actually given to us, but you totally assume certain things and then you turn out to be wrong.
Yeah. Absolutely. And there are kind of, as we spoke about earlier, there are kind of brief outlines that Christie gives that really shape a character very quickly in our eyes. And I think she really weaponizes that in this book, where she creates this kind of outline of Arlena Stuart, where we are, as the audience, kind of reading into her things that we, as you say, haven't been proven, haven't been assumed.
Yeah. Yeah, and we, I teach crime and thriller writing at master's level in Cambridge University. And one of the things that I'm always, whenever I've ever taught crime fiction, one of the things I always say is that yes, the duty of a crime writer is to mislead the reader, but it's even better on those occasions when we can just stand back and do nothing and allow the reader to mislead themselves.
Ah, say more about that.
So let me try and think. Okay, I'll give you an example from one of my books that isn't a paro novel. So in one of my crime novels, one of my contemporary crime novels, somebody asks somebody else to show them their passport as proof of, I think the police ask a woman to show them her passport as proof of her identity. And she shows them a passport and makes some offhand remark along the lines of, you know, yeah, I'm afraid it doesn't look much like me. You know, it's not very flattering. And the policeman thinks, yes, you're much more attractive in real life or whatever. And at that point, the reader is meant to think, oh, yes, I know lots of examples of people not looking like their passport photo. Mm-hmm. Because we all have that in our anecdotal experience, endless examples where we look at someone's passport photo and go, that looks nothing like you. Now, in fact, in the scenario in my book, the woman is presenting a completely different person's passport. and it's not her. She's lying about who she is.
Right.
And I'm in that scene when I show her showing the passport and saying, yeah, it's not very flattering, sorry. And the policeman thinks, no, you're much more attractive in real life. I am relying on the reader thinking, oh, of course, no one looks like their passport photo. So the reader uses what they know of passport photos in real life to mislead themselves and assume that this must just be a passport photo that, like all those other ones, doesn't look like its owner. And in fact, what's really going on is someone's lying about their identity and using a fake passport. So that is an example of, I didn't have to do anything to mislead the reader. I just knew that at that point, they would be assuming that nobody looks anything like their passport photo. So that's just one example. And something very similar structurally happens in Evil Under the Sun in relation to Arlena Stewart and what we think about her.
That's right. And I said before that this was kind of the critical reception of this book was that it was so complex that people kind of said, like, only Christie could write this kind of book. It's so complicated. And it does have a lot of twists and turns to it. But I think that it doesn't even feel like a suspension of disbelief. It just feels like a really crazy thing that happened on holiday as you're reading it.
I don't even think it's that complicated. It makes me laugh sometimes when people describe, sometimes, especially, you know, recently when everyone's got such a short attention span, if people say a book is complicated, they often mean, you know, the narrative isn't entirely linear from start to finish. There's more than three characters. Right. I think Evil Under the Sun is at the perfect point on the kind of Richter scale between too simple and too complicated. It's just it's appropriately twisted, but it's not too complicated, I think.
No, I mean, obviously the mystery holds up. It's a very, as I said, you don't need to suspend disbelief. It doesn't feel like you're kind of going like, well, come on, that's just too much. It feels very much like something that you're kind of watching happen on holiday and you're going like, oh my God. So I agree with you. But to say a little bit more about kind of the perfect point between too simple and too complicated. What is too complicated for you?
I mean, I actually quite like complicated crime fiction as long as I don't lose track of who is who. You know, if there's a lot of characters, that's fine. If there's too many characters and they're all vying for the position of main character, then I can sometimes think there's just too many people here. Or if there's too many twists or too much going on, then obviously that will put me off, as it would put off many readers. But I have a high tolerance for twists and complication. And as long as I can follow it all, then I'm very happy with that. I can think of a couple of crime novels where at a certain point I've thought, really? Another twist? There have already been 17 twists.
Right.
And I can think of one crime novel in particular where there were just too many main characters. There were about 17 main characters. Mm. And each time we went to a different point of view, you'd forgotten about that person because you'd had the other 16 points of view.
Right.
Immediately before. But it's very rare, actually, for me to think something is too complicated. But certainly with Agatha Christie, I would say the most complex of her books structurally is Lord Edgware Dies.
And
that's the only one where when I got to the end, I thought, actually, I kind of wish I'd made notes to properly understand how all this fits together. But I think, you know, I still loved it. It's still one of my favourite Christie novels. And I think certainly Evil Under the Sun cannot justifiably be accused of being too complicated.
Mm. Yeah, and I also think that one of the things, as you said, Christie does so well is she always has like kind of the right number of characters, and they're always at kind of the right level of exposure within the book to make them not quite the main character, but you understand who they are and you're invested in them. And in fact, I found it interesting that in, for example, when she wrote Death on the Nile for the stage, which she called Hidden Horizons, she took Poirot out because he felt like he drew too much attention as the main character. So I think she is so aware of that balance of character exposure and kind of who's vying for attention at a given moment. And that's kind
Absolutely. And she also takes Poirot out of The Hollow in the stage play version.
Ah, interesting.
He's in the novel of The Hollow, but he's not in the stage play.
That is so fascinating because the novel, The Hollow, is one of my favorite.
Yes, mine too.
Yeah, and to not have him in there would be, I can actually imagine it. I can imagine what that would be like because he is in so many ways the audience of that book. You know, he's constantly being placed as like the audience of a cinema that's ongoing that he really could be pulled out, I think, quite easily.
I have to say, I mean, Christie always says, or said rather, that she regretted putting Poirot in the novel of The Hollow.
Ah.
I think possibly her publisher felt they were due a Poirot novel and she wanted the story of The Hollow and she just sort of stuffed him in there. But I have to say, I do love him in the book. You know, yes, he is like the audience for the action, but it works for me.
Yes.
I would not prefer The Hollow not to have Poirot in it.
No, I completely agree with you. I love how he acts as the audience. And in fact, I think it is kind of Christie's understanding of how cinematic her work is that is like at play in that book. She really, that's really like highlighted throughout The Hollow. And I just love that book. I think it's so fantastic in so many ways. But I didn't know that about the stage adaptation. That's so interesting.
No, there's no Poirot in the stage version of The Hollow.
Wow. Very interesting. I'll have to take a look and read it. Does it have a different name or is it just called The Hollow?
No, it's still called The Hollow. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. But then I think Poirot is perfectly placed within Evil Under the Sun. I don't think you could take him out. Everything kind of turns on him in that book.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think Evil Under the Sun, you know, if somebody said, I've never read a Poirot novel, give me a perfect example of the species, I would give them Evil Under the Sun.
Really? That's so interesting. You're turning me around. I like Evil Under the Sun very much, but I wouldn't have put it as my quintessential Poirot, but you're convincing me.
There's also something very, I don't really know how to describe this exactly, but there's such a kind of oxygenated, expansive feel to it. And one of the Poirot novels that people rave about and rate very highly is Five Little Pigs.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not a fan of that novel at all.
Really?
I like it. I think it's brilliant. You know, I'm not saying I don't like it, but it wouldn't be in my top 20 Agatha Christie novels. And part of the reason for that is that it has a very sort of shut down, airless feel to it compared to, say, Evil Under the Sun or Appointment with Death or Murder in Mesopotamia, where you really feel as though you're in a fully imagined fictional world with colour and noise and stuff going on. I don't know. There's something about Evil Under the Sun that feels properly expansive and exuberant, whereas Five Little Pigs to me has always felt like sort of being pushed into a slightly airless cupboard. That's a really weird way to talk about books. But
I completely understand. I think I hear what you're saying, and I definitely feel that there's a pressure element to Five Little Pigs, especially because you're also reading so many different narratives. I happen to love Five Little Pigs, but I completely see what you're saying about the kind of expansive versus the enclosed.
But I
think that lends an urgency for me when I read Five Little Pigs. And I think that urgency is there, just there in a different way with Evil Under the Sun, in terms of kind of the solving of the murder and what is propelling Poirot forward. Interesting. Well, Sophie, I have just had such a great time speaking with you. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk. And where could people find you? Would you like to be found? And where can people find you on all the social platforms and so on?
Yeah, sorry, that was my dog growling in the... He likes to go to sleep at 7 o'clock, and he gets awake.
It's way past his bedtime.
So my website is sophiehannah.com.
Yeah.
And at the bottom of the homepage, you can sign up to receive my author newsletter, which is where I share all my news and gossip about forthcoming Poirot novels and other exciting things I'm up to. In fact, one of the exciting things I'm up to is that I'm about to release a movie.
Wow.
With a friend of mine, we co-wrote a murder mystery musical called The Mystery of Mr. E.
Oh my gosh, that's fantastic.
Picture Agatha Christie's The Mousetrap, but with lots of catchy songs. That's kind of the general vibe of it. And that movie is coming out either next year or the year after. So there's going to be lots of gossip in my newsletter about all the movie stuff. So that's at sophiehannah.com. And then on the socials, I'm on Twitter as SophieHannahCB1. I'm on Instagram as SophieHannahWriter. And I'm on Facebook as SophieHannahAuthor.
We will have all of those in the episode notes so people can click through and follow you on all the platforms, and definitely sign up for the newsletter because that is very, very exciting. I will also say that, for lovers of Agatha Christie, definitely take a look at your Poirot books, at Sophie Hannah's Poirot books. They are so well written. They capture Poirot so nicely. But as you say, you don't take on her voice. It is a different voice. It's a different character. Edward Catchpole is a totally different kind of character than Hastings, which I appreciated very much. He's not kind of a doofus. Yeah. I love Hastings, but he is a doofus.
I wanted Catchpole to be someone clever enough to benefit from Poirot's expert mentorship.
Absolutely. And he's an empathetic character, and he's a nuanced character. I really enjoy him. So check all of those out as well. And we'll have all of those linked in the episode notes. Thank you so, so much for being here. It's been such a pleasure.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Have a great night, Sophie.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Thank you to our producer, Kate Grishel, and our sound engineer, Winter Robinson. If you want to support this podcast, you can follow us on Instagram at TNMurder. You can rate and review us on iTunes, and you can tell all your friends and even strangers to follow us on your podcast platform of choice. Our next episode is the ABC Murders. Rent it from your local library, buy from your local independent bookstore, or if you need to buy online, we recommend bookshop.org, which supports independent bookstores with every purchase. A link for next episode's book can be found in the episode notes. Our next episode is actually the last of the season, so thank you so much for joining us for season one of Tea and Murder. Season two will come out in the fall, but we'll be dropping a few little gems in between, so keep an eye on your podcast feed and Instagram. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Tea and Murder. We hope you had a bracing dose of both.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.